Welcome to this short first episode of Spin Notes. Spin Notes are going to be short episodes which, by popular request, in other words, some feedback we've had from our audience, are going to try to explain and explore some of the things we've talked about, a key concept, a textbook, or an idea that has come up in the Spinoza triad. It's also partly a response to the fact that Richard and I and Dan find it very difficult to get together regularly, so to fill in the gaps, as it were, we're going to try Spin Notes. What do you think the world is? I know this is a rather open-ended question, but I'm guessing that it is a question that you don't ask yourself very much. I don't particularly. I'm not really asking what the meaning of life is, whether it has some theological purpose, some grand design, but simply what the world is. Now, unless you're a biologist or a doctor or a physicist or a quantum physicist or an experimental physicist or a cosmologist, you'll produce a general kind of answer that's something like this. You'll say, well, I imagine that most things in the world are made up of atoms. They're tiny particles of one kind or another that exist in complex ways and combine to produce everything we see before us. I also know that the diversity of creatures on this Earth are probably produced by a random process called natural selection, in which creatures have existed before our time, and dinosaurs and mammoths and such, and that we may not exist one day, and new and diverse types of creature may exist on this Earth after we're gone. Life is diverse, random, evolving. I also look at the world and I don't really imagine that it's particularly governed by superstition. I may occasionally cross my fingers or cast a small prayer when the plane is going through a lot of turbulence, but generally speaking, I don't think there are gods and spirits. I don't think my life is governed by superstitious principles. I doubt that gods can be angered. If I do think of God at all, I park him somewhere to one side of my life to be observed in occasional rituals. But really, my life as it exists on a day-to-day basis is my own, and it's governed by rational principles of cause and effect. Things happen because they have causes. I can ascertain those causes through rational thinking. Atomic principles, natural selection, and rationality. These are probably the underpinning ideas or principles in which you observe the world around you. And when you do that, you might think of yourself as particularly modern. In this episode of Spin Notes, I talk to Richard about a book that I think is one of the most interesting, most fascinating books to exist. Not only because it is great literature, although I can't read it in its original Latin, but because it is simply profoundly astonishing. Over 2,000 years ago, a Roman called Titus Lucretius Carus wrote the poem, the extended long poem, De Rerum Natura, which translates as something along the lines of On the Nature of Things. It's a bit like writing a book called What Life Means or Why Things Are the Way They Are. I'd like to make that pitch to a publisher. My book, The Way the World Is. Well, you wouldn't attempt that today in a way because you'd think that there would be far too many specialists, far too many experts who would know far too much. In the first century BCE, the poet known as Lucretius wrote a book inspired by the philosophy of Epicureanism in which he described atomism, atomic theory. He didn't invent atomism. The ancient Greeks had proposed the idea that things, objects, material objects, matter, was made up of tiny, finite and infinitely combining particles. However, atomic principles, natural selection, or at least the random production of life, and materialism and rationalism. It's as modern a book as can be imagined, written in Latin hexameter verse. The most extraordinary book. The writer Stephen Greenblatt describes its remarkable survival. The book was written by one author, no other works are known by Lucretius. It certainly is an original. It's survived in its original, possibly unfinished form. It wasn't concocted in the Middle Ages. It's not a product of a modern hoax. But it was written in the 1st century BCE at about the same time as Julius Caesar was around. The Roman Empire hadn't yet reached its height. Lucretius was probably a prosperous Roman. Wealthy enough to be commented on by others. Certainly the book is known about long before copies of it were discovered. Writers such as Cicero comment on it. It was admired, although Epicureanism wasn't the dominant philosophy of the Roman world at the time. In Spin Notes, I discuss this book and my enthusiasm and admiration for it with Richard.
Well, it was you that first told me about this book and its relationship to Epicurus, John. I think it was once, many years ago, over a coffee in a break.
Its relationship to Epicureanism is that, I mean, Epicurus is the Greek philosopher of the 3rd, 4th century boundary. So he's just after Aristotle. And he's an Athenian philosopher, travels around the islands. I think he goes to Samos and he comes back to Athens and he sets up a school after the school of Plato's school and after Aristotle's school, Lyceum and the Academy and so on. He sets up a school called the Garden. And it's open to women, it's open to men, and you know, and he espouses a philosophy of Epicureanism or hedonism, and pain and pleasure. The absence, the pleasure is the absence of pain. Lucretius, on the other hand, is a Roman of the 1st century BC, so you're nearly 300 years later. Almost nothing's known about him. He's clearly an Epicurean, but Epicureanism is really popular in Rome. It's not the dominant idea. The dominant philosophy is Stoicism in the 1st century BC. But when they got into the library at Pompeii, the Villa of the Papyri, as it's called, the Villa of the Papyri because they found these papyrus scrolls. So they find an aristocrat's library of books, and books in those days are scrolls. And they've been turned and have been carbonized and into blocks. and they cannot be read, and they try and break them apart, they can't read them, they turn to dust and all this stuff. These papyrus scrolls, and now they can sort of read some of them because they can scan them without trying to unfurl them in some manner technical. And what they've discovered is this library is largely Epicurean. So there's a rich Roman of the 1st century BC, 1st century AD, actually, that's Pompeii. So he's reading sort of Epicureanism. So Epicureanism is a fairly mainstream idea among the wealthy.
Right.
And lots of these papyri books, they refer to Epicurean thought and lots of references to Epicurus and references to Lucretius, and mostly they're by a philosopher called Philodemus. But Lucretius is a rich Roman, probably a rich Roman, nothing's known about him much, and he writes an extended Latin poem in hexameter verse, trying to explain to Romans the ideas of Epicurus. So that's what it is. He's basically an exponent. Probably all the ideas in it are what he has gained from reading Epicurean philosophers and Epicurus and books of Epicurus that have since been lost, but he's referring to. So what little of Epicurus has remained, and there's very little remained, he's only ever quoted by other people, as it were, the principal exponent left to us of Epicureanism is Lucretius. It's in verse, so it's in what's known as hexameter.
Yeah.
One of its reasons it survived is because it's pretty wonderful Latin. I mean, I can't read Latin. But which you don't get in a clear. There are all sorts of translations and people have translated it to try and capture the beauty. And there's a lot of poetic analogies to it. So he's using lots of poetic metaphors and poetic ideas. He's trying to explain to you what Epicurus is about.
Right.
But for those that read Latin, It's a very high form, a very structured, very beautiful. So for schoolboys of the 19th century, translate that. That's how you do Latin. That's
right.
The best. So it's classic high Latin poetry.
Material objects are of two kinds: atoms and compounds of atoms. The atoms themselves cannot be swamped by any force, for they are preserved indefinitely by their absolute solidity. If atom stocks are inexhaustible, greater than power of living things to count, if nature's same creative power were present too, to throw the atoms into unions exactly as they unite now, why then confess you must that other worlds exist in other regions of the sky, and different tribes of men kinds of wild beasts. Lucretius, on the nature of things.
It's six books which cover why the universe is the way it is, why you shouldn't fear death, and what's your relationship with the gods. It's science, but it's science not as we know it. Extremely empiricist. So he says, this is the world as we see it. And I'm a clever person, so I'm going to explain to you, using the ideas of Epicurus, I'm going to explain to you how the world is. Like, for instance, if you or I were convinced the world is as it appears, and you said, well, I was sitting in my bedroom the other day and I saw a shaft of sunlight, and in it there were little specks of something or other. The universe is made. This wasn't an original idea. This is basically going back to the Greeks, atomists. What you're seeing there is there are tiny particles of things which make up air and make up sunlight and make up light and make up thought and make up your soul. They're made of tiny particles. So the universe is made of minute atomic particles.
There is not anything which returns to nothing, but all things return dissolved into their elements. If the world is the product of nothing but natural forces and natural law, divine intervention is impossible. The atoms in it must be used over and over again. Thus, the death of one thing becomes necessary for the birth of another. Lucretius, on the nature of things.
Not bad.
That seems to make a kind of empirical sense, just because of my observation around me. I can't see air, but I can feel it. So what's hitting my hand then? Well, it must be invisible, tiny particles. When I light a fire, it goes up into the air, and so on. So all the evidence you have, it's a bit. But except what you're going to rule out is magic, superstition.
And where do the gods come into this?
The gods are just simply, they're a feature of nature. I think we talked about this earlier in the previous podcast about Stoicism, that as far as the Epicureans are concerned, unlike the Stoics believe there's a sort of force of good working behind the universe. But for the Epicureans, the gods are simply creatures, unusually powerful ones. They're not interested in us at all and have no effect on our lives. No more than if you came across a lion. It might be dangerous to get too close to it, or a unicorn for that matter.
The main obstacles to the goal of tranquility of mind are our unnecessary fears and desires, and the only way to eliminate these is to study natural science. The most serious disturbances of all are fear of death, including fear of punishment after death, and fear of the gods. Scientific inquiry removes fear of death by showing that the mind and the spirit are material and mortal, so that they cannot live on after we die. As Epicurus neatly and logically puts it, death is nothing to us. When we exist, death is not present, and when death is present, we do not exist. Consequently, it does not concern either the living or the dead, since for the living it is non-existent and the dead no longer exist. As for fear of the gods, that disappears when scientific investigation proves that the world was formed by a fortuitous concourse of atoms, that the gods live outside the world and have no inclination or power to intervene in its affairs, and that irregular phenomena such as lightning, thunder, volcanic eruptions, and earthquakes have natural causes and are not manifestations of divine anger. Lucretius, on the nature of things.
Does Lucretius talk about Stoicism? That was the dominant way of living then. Were there opposing camps?
I mean, Cicero, you know about Lucretius a bit because he refers to Lucretius. Cicero refers to Lucretius, so he's writing on his letters. He writes about this wonderful poet, Lucretius. So you sort of know that Lucretius wasn't made up. It wasn't a pretend character. It wasn't invented by a medieval monk. There's some thought that the book on nature of things might have been made up by a medieval monk or something. There's classical references, and Cicero's a Stoic and doesn't really like the Epicureans. So he admires the poetry of Lucretius. Now, the Stoics are dominant thought. I mean, this is about how you live according to precepts of discipline and creativity and hard work, and also trying to find the essential goodness of the universe, which is operating in the background. You know, there is a thought, a logos, working in the universe towards, it's very Hegelian, towards goodness in the future. Whereas for the Epicureans, there's no meaning to anything, but that shouldn't worry you, because the world is simply materialistic. It's utterly materialistic. It's what you see before you. For modern people, it's both incredibly modern, but I can't entirely trust my senses.
What about how they view pleasure?
For a Stoic, the pleasure is in making the sun run, beating the inevitability of death by making your life as worthwhile as possible.
It is not that we have a short time to live, but that we waste a lot of it. Life is long enough, and a sufficiently generous amount has been given to us for the highest achievements if it were all well invested. But when it is wasted in heedless luxury and spent on no good activity, we are forced at last by death's final constraint to realize that it has passed away before we knew it was passing. So it is. We are not given a short life, but we make it short. And we are not ill supplied, but wasteful of it. Life is long, if you know how to use it. The Roman Stoic, Seneca.
Yeah.
Whereas the Epicureans are going to, and Lucretius, are going to outline a philosophy, famously, of hedonism, which is the absence of pain. But not stuff yourself with cakes and beer. It's moderation. But it's principally that if you stuff yourself with cakes and beer, you'll let yours find pain. If you pursue ambition and fruitless attempts to make the world different, and you can't change it, you'll find pain. Effectively, it's almost Buddhist. It's a sort of acceptance. Yeah. Of the world the way it is, modest pleasures, and the most modest of all pleasures is the absence of pain. Well, that doesn't entirely work, does it, for you and me? It sort of works.
The key there with this stuff is moderation. The Stoicism, the outcome's pretty similar as well, because you're meant to remain indifferent to things that you can't control. So the Stoics would have had that indifference to pleasure. For Epicurus, though you pursue pleasure, you pursue it moderately.
It's that definition of pleasure as the absence of pain. And that's what we were talking about at the beginning. You know, are you happy because you're not now working on the kitchen, which is going to give you pain? Or are you not? If I stab myself in the leg,
it's taking a long time.
Yeah. It's, you know, there is, we know that there are all sorts of pleasures. If I sit here now thinking, well, am I actually in any pain? I feel relatively painless. I'm having a nice chat. This must be as good as human life gets.
Yeah.
Well, no, it isn't as good as human life gets. There is some nagging suspicion that I could want more. And then the Epicurean comes back and says, you've got to rid yourself of that. That foolish thought there's always more. You've got to distance yourself from that sense. It's extremely hard to do.
A man leaves his house because he's bored with life at home and suddenly returns, finding himself no happier abroad. He rushes off to his villa, driving like mad. You'd think he's going to a house on fire, and yawns before he's put a foot inside, or falls asleep and seeks oblivion, or even rushes back to town again. So each man flies from himself. Vain hope, because it clings to him the more closely against his will, and hates himself because he is sick in mind, and does not know the cause of his disease. Lucretius, On the Nature of Things.
A large part of it would be contemporary, isn't it? That almost like a mindfulness of enjoying the sort
Very
of simple
much.
Pleasures.
Simple pleasures being the absence of pain. Avoid those things. We've all had you'd wake with a massive hangover and think, well, I thought I was having an absolutely brilliant time last night, but I think I'll never do that ever again at the moment.
Yeah.
I've achieved pain through my pleasure. So by knowing the world the way it is, you can then content yourself. Lucretius is mainly concerned with telling you how the world is. So the world is, it's as it appears.
Yeah.
It's made up of atoms. You can tell this by simply observing it properly. They're looking, you're trusting your eyes. You can see what's in front of you. Things change. One thing changes into another. Natural scientists of the time, they're concerned with first causes. I throw a stone in a river. I know what caused that, me throwing the stone. But what caused me? What caused me to think about throwing the stone? So you keep going back in, you know, back.
Yeah.
What's the original thing that causes the thing? And if everything is made of minute particles of atoms, what causes these things to form into trees and leaves and antelopes and so on? There are only two things in nature, the atoms and the void. And in the void, the atoms exist. Well, why aren't they just stable? Right. Why isn't the whole universe just a mist of atoms?
Yeah.
And that's because they're curious, and it doesn't make any scientific sense for us. Well, it doesn't. The atoms collide occasionally, swerve together. And in their collision, some atoms connect and some don't. Well, he's describing natural selection. He doesn't know he's describing natural selection, but it is natural selection. It's not very far away from modern physics. And the swerve and the random nature of tiny particles, you could say that's quantum probability. Oddly modern. I don't we have to say this, man, God almighty, he's discovered quantum physics and evolutionary stuff. But it does speak to us in a very rational way. The world being that way, me and you have nothing to fear. We have nothing to fear because that rids you of fear of the gods. It rids you of fear of tormenting demons, shoving red hot pokers up your bum after you're dead. It rids you of, I need to be living a certain way. You know you don't. You need a very simple life because there's very little, the universe is governed largely by random nature.
Right, yeah.
So in that sense, free yourself of fear. So his most famous passages are that, about how the thing that most is going to most upset me and upset you is a belief that there's something external to you that's observing you, some feeling you should be achieving, some feeling that the gods are going to judge you when you die. If you rid yourself of all that, it's a material world of which you have little control over things, so don't worry about them.
Yeah.
And therefore relax.
There is no murky pit of hell awaiting anyone. Mind cannot arise alone without body, or apart from sinews and blood. You must admit, therefore, that when your body has perished, there is an end also of the spirit diffused through it. It is surely crazy to couple a mortal object with an eternal. Your life is death already. Though you live and though you see, except that half your time you waste in sleep and the other half you snore with eyes wide open, forever seeing dreams, forever in panic, forever lacking wit to find out what the trouble is, depressed or drunk or drifting aimlessly around. Lucretius, On the Nature of Things.
So what does he say about death? Because I know
I'm
curious. Had a lot to say about that, and I'm assuming it must come through this book. I've got to read it. I got it from when we spoke. We did the other podcast, and I got it. It's on my list, my ever-growing pile of books to read. Well,
he devotes one of the whole book. There's six books in there, and the sixth one of those books, I think it's the fifth one or something, is devoted entirely to why you shouldn't worry about death.
Right. And in the summary, John, why shouldn't I worry about this?
Well, he gives a lot of arguments. I mean, but the most famous argument is the symmetry argument. And the symmetry argument is that you've already been dead. It's before you were born. And you didn't worry then, did you? So your non-existence before you were born and your non-existence after you're dead. Since you have non-existence after you're dead, you can't fear something that's nothing. If you're afraid of death because you're just concerned about what it might be like, well, you've already tried it. And you weren't worried in the years before you were born.
Yeah.
If you're worried about not coming back in the world, your soul won't return. It's true, they won't. Then enjoy life while you're here. I don't know how convincing you find that. If I said to you, don't worry, Richard, you've already been dead before you were born.
I mean, I guess I don't know how many people fear death in that sense. I think the dying part is a bit, the decline. Decline and dying. Probably a sticking point. And also the thought of not having loved ones. I mean, that's, I think, for most people would be, it's just a great unknown, isn't it, death? And it's quite a strong argument, isn't it?
Oh, well, that one he knocks on the head, you see. It's not the great unknown.
Right.
Because you've been there already. So that one he can successfully destroy. You don't worry about demons and spirits and angels and such like. And don't worry about what it might be like in some way. That won't like it. Because you've already been dead. What they can't get rid of, and you're absolutely right, I think the most powerful objection is, but I'm alive now. And I love cheese. for a start. I love my children. I don't want to lose my children in the now. I'm now alive. Before I was born, I'd never been alive. I had nothing to lose. But now I'm alive, I have this to lose. Epicureanism and Lucretius can't get rid of that.
The finite nature of the way in which he's putting things across there would mean he's basically saying to enjoy life while you're here.
Yes, in a modest way.
Enjoy it not too much.
And he also says in the book that if you do face pain, horrible old age, and Epicurus himself died quite painfully, got some sort of kidney stones or something, and was in diabolical agony for months before he died.
Right.
And he apparently put up with this with tremendous, what we'd call stoicism. You know, he put up with it very well and said, well, you know, I'm happy because I'm just thinking about the nice times I've had. Well, again, I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll get me through.
God, dear, yeah. I think life and death then perhaps would have been viewed in a slightly different context to us now, wouldn't it? We're sort of mediated from that in our society, aren't we? 2,000 years ago, it was something that people faced more regularly than we do.
Yeah, I mean, I think they dealt with it in very modern ways in a way. I mean, I think the Romans and the Stoics and the Greeks dealt with it in the sense of achieve. Be a great consul. You know, be a great general.
Right.
Hey, do something with your life. Or maybe the Epicurean might say, well, you know, don't worry about these things. You need to live a life of moderation and absence of pain. Curiously, what is my and your response to the thought of death? It's A, not to think about it, because hey, what can I do about it?
Yeah.
Or it's to, maybe I'll leave something behind. Maybe some podcast will float off into the future. And that'll be my legacy. Yeah. Or I shan't worry about my legacy. I'll just go out this afternoon and sit in the garden and have a bit of cheese and a glass of wine, you know, and I'll be comfortable. What else can you do? Those are our responses to death. What they aren't, though, is a medieval response to death. You know, one thing I'm not going to do this afternoon is, like
Thomas More,
put a stone in my shoe
in order to cause myself constant pain, or like Thomas More did, wear a hair shirt, constantly remind me of being uncomfortable and in pain the whole time. Some years ago, I was on holiday in Southern Ireland, and the far tip of Southern Ireland, there's a place you can take a day trip out to. It's called Skellig Michael. It's a small rocky island.
It's where they filmed one of the last scenes of the last Star Wars. It's basically a rocky crag that sits out in the Atlantic. And as far as in medieval times they were concerned, that was the edge of the world. If you sailed out from Ireland, you're going off the planet. The world was flat. You're going to go beyond that is monsters and waterfalls, a bit oblivion. So the medieval monks, built a little sort of horrible little shelters on the top. They're freezing in winter, and the storms were terrible. And they spent months and years, they spent years, in fact, several lifetimes building a stone stairway up the side of this thing. It's just about the most uncomfortable and awful place to live. Well, what were they thinking? They were mortifying themselves. They were punishing their body for the sin of life. Well, that's very medieval. That strand of Christianity, or in strand of all sorts of religions, that make you guilty of being alive and ask you to think of the next world, well, Lucretius rejects all that.
For fools admire and love those things they see hidden in verses, turned all upside down, and take for truth what sweetly strokes the ears and comes with sounds of phrases fine imbued. To such heights of evil are men driven by religion. Lucretius, On the Nature of Things.
Yeah.
Which is why it was considered an absolutely heretical book. But it survives because of its brilliant Latin. So it becomes, you know, it's kind of like, read this disgusting book. But it's in beautiful Latin, so learn the Latin. Or it's written by non-Christians, so we know they're wrong. So it survives the medieval period. It gets down to like one copy. A writer called Stephen Greenblatt, who describes how a medieval librarian book collector finds literally the last copy of this book. They'd sort of known it was existence because Cicero refers to Lucretius and other people refer to Lucretius. But the book had been gone. It got down to like one last copy. And it survives by being recopied because probably of the beauty of the Latin and because the ideas are quite thrilling. So you could imagine it being sort of like passed under the table by the monks.
They're quite favourable ideas now, aren't they? I think the idea of being with friends. I think everyone kind of knows that a large part of the living that we do now is unnecessary, and it's buying stuff that you don't need, and the consumption of certain goods, they're not going to make you any happier, just make you worse almost. You're not going to achieve happiness in that route. And it's that we've laughed before about, you know, joked with ideology, you know, but all the same, yes. You know, we just carry on doing it anyway.
Oh, completely. Yeah.
It feels like that very much disrupts that, doesn't it? It offers an alternative.
No, I think it does feel very appealing, the idea that you buy things and then they break. There's a pursuit of material goods that will never quite satisfy.
Yeah.
But I'll put this to you, Richard, because I know that if this afternoon, instead of fixing the kitchen, you wandered into town and saw in a shop window a 100-year-old steel guitar that was, yep, for some reason, a remarkably cheap price, this would, yeah, give you a great deal of pleasure.
It certainly would, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't think it would be a pleasure that would result in some kind of later on pain. An acquisition of a material thing that would give you pleasure.
Again, though, it's reading that Lucretius's point and the Epicurean point with the eye of that moderation, isn't it? Is that perhaps if you were to have one steel guitar of 100 years old, or maybe two, or you know, that continually getting more and more of them isn't going to make you more and more happy. There's that moderate kind of middle ground with it, isn't it? Which I think is largely missing nowadays. You know, terms like moderation don't seem as appealing now, do they?
They don't.
And excess and having lots of stuff.
In the news this week, you discover the Chancellor's wife, Rishi Sunak's wife, is colossally rich. She gets an interest on some investments, £11 million a year, just on interest. That's just one of her sources of income. She gets £11 million a year. And she had a choice at some point in the past. She thought, well, I can register non-domestic taxpayer, or I can register as a domestic taxpayer. And I'll have £2 million less a year if I do one. Well, I'll have the £2 million on top of the 11, you know. You think, well, okay, so in other words, clearly for you, there isn't enough or moderation. Yeah. It's, I'll have whatever I can get.
What's that? I've still got... And this is the thing, apparently, COVID brain fog. What was the philosophers that did the... It started with Peter Singer. They worked out what you needed to be happy. And it's about 20 or so grand in the UK. Effective altruism. Then they worked out what would bring maximum for your money, what would bring the most good in the world. So anything over what you would need for your humble living, anything you earn over that gets donated to mosquito nets. I probably butchered that very badly, but...
Yeah, effective altruism suggests that you should use your income to the maximum benefit of others. So you do a calculation that mosquito nets are better than guide dogs or tractors, since tractors and guide dogs are much more expensive and aid fewer people. So what the most good you can do with the minimum amount of money, or the maximum amount of money, the most efficient use of your resources in the world to do the maximum amount of good. Of course, it relies on a subjective idea of what good is, and that keeping people alive using mosquito nets is universally better than providing employment through consumption in the West of goods produced in developing countries, or that to keep people alive using mosquito nets doesn't do anything about the inequalities of a system that reduces poverty and war.
Yeah.
So you might be keeping people alive in order that they should die in wars or work their lives away in sweatshops. Or you might not be able to judge exactly what the good merits, or you know, the merits are of the difference between writing a poem or producing a play or being a teacher in a school than producing a mosquito net, which you can measure. That's only because largely with effective altruism, the effectiveness comes in the measurability of life survival.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a bad thing, but the Epicureans might come back and say something like, doing no harm is not doing no good. And I know that a criticism of the Epicureans from people like Cicero was that sitting in your garden with your bit of cheese and glass of wine or glass of water was ultimately self-centered. It did nothing. It didn't attack the world's problems or the world, or didn't seek creative greatness in any response. It was ultimately selfish. And of course, that comes to the question of whether doing no harm and living a life of moderation is itself an act of altruism. Poor humanity, to saddle the gods with such a responsibility and throw in a vindictive temper. What griefs they hatch for themselves, what festering sores for us, what tears for our prosperity. This is not piety, this oft-repeated show of bowing a veiled head before a graven image, this bustling to every altar, this kowtowing and prostration on the ground with palms outspread before the shrines of the gods, this deluging of vow on vow. True piety lies rather in the power to contemplate the universe with a quiet mind.
But of course, the trouble is with the Stoics and the Epicureans and Lucretius is us moderns, to some extent, we're going to say something like this. I hear you've given half, you've limited your income and you're giving the rest to mosquito nets. Well, that's not an unselfish act, because you're getting the pleasure of helping others. Now you're telling me about it. So in fact, it's not an unselfish act. It's an act of virtue signaling.
Right.
You know, in fact, then you get to the idea of what is the virtuous act? And you have to come right down the years to get to Kant or something like that and say, well, they're very difficult to find the virtuous act until you come up with utterly rational acts that are themselves good in themselves.
Right.
But the Epicureans aren't worried about any of that.
Right. I find it appealing. I like Epicurus. I mean, I like the idea of hanging around with friends, you know, just taking life a bit slower. And there's that great one when we did the other podcast on Stoicism, and we mentioned Epicurus in that, didn't we? But the Travels with Epicurus, Daniel Klein's book, this one, I thought was really, really good. It goes back to Greece. It studied when he was younger, and it's about Epicurus and aging. Definitely worth reading.
But there is nothing sweeter than to dwell in towers that rise on high, serene and fortified with teachings of the wise, from which you may peer down upon the others as they stray this way and that, seeking the path of life, losing their way, the skirmishing of wits, the scramble for a noun, the fight, each striving harder than the next, and struggling day and night to climb atop a heap of riches and lay claim to might. O miserable minds of men, O hearts that cannot see, beset by such great dangers and in such obscurity, you spend your little lot of life. Don't you know it's plain that all your nature calls for its body free from pain and to enjoy pleasure, a mind removed from fear and care? And so we see the body's needs are altogether spare, only the bare minimum to keep suffering at bay. Yet which can furnish pleasures for us in a wide array? Crecius, On the Nature of Things.
Because the thing about Epicurus is, if you come across this in the medieval times, not only is it passed under the table in a bit sort of naughty and all that stuff, and you don't read it for not admiring the Latin, the idea is, by the time you get to the Renaissance, by the time you get to the Enlightenment, these ideas are just incredibly, I mean, Thomas Jefferson owned about 4 copies of On the Nature of Things. And what does he start the Declaration of Independence with? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, yeah. I think Jefferson's idea of the pursuit of happiness in the Declaration of Independence is not a million miles away from Epicurus. I don't think Jefferson was thinking pursuit of happiness is accruing lots of money and owning lots of cars, or living a life of high consumption. Jefferson, although he did live a life fairly luxurious and he owned slaves and all this stuff, but if you ignore all that, I think he had an idea of a kind of rural simplicity that would be satisfying to most people. In other words, he's highly influenced by Epicurus and by Lucretius.
It is an appealing idea, isn't it? I think thinking about your life, you know, if you have a day off, spending it in the sun with friends, moderately drinking and eating, or, you know, not drinking, or just, you know, just enjoying the moment is appealing.
For the Stoics, you're wasting time. You should be doing something creative. A critic of the Epicurean view that you're sitting in the garden having a nice time, but you know this must end.
Yeah.
And another critic might be, well, yes, you're sitting in a garden having a nice time, but someone out there must be working somewhere in order that you can do this. Very much a philosophy of the comfortable, which without the, you know, there's sometimes hard work must be done.
I mean, John, you said at the beginning, I always felt like with Stoicism, one of the issues with it would be any form of political change. And it doesn't really deal too well with that, because Karl Marx did his PhD, Epicurus.
Yeah, you can see the influence on Marx's materialism to the way the world operates. It can be understood by rational minds. If Nietzsche says God is dead, well, Lucretius said it two millennia earlier. If Freud says the fear of death shapes the human psyche, well, Lucretius said it two millennia earlier. If Hegel says that history is evolving through collision, through a dialectic, well, that's Lucretius' swerve, collision of atoms and the formation of the new. There you have Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche, Freud. You have the modern world.
And the most remarkable thing about Lucretius is he's a man of 2,000 years ago, using his mind to simply try and understand the physics of the universe. And the answers he comes up with are not a million miles away from modern physics. They're not using test and hypothesis or any of that kind. It's just simply, I'll look at the world and see what makes sense to me. I'll push aside all the hobgoblins and spirits and tradition, just because it's always been done that way, and start as if the world were a blank sheet and I'm observing it. That's remarkable.
Yeah, it's going to go up on my list of books that I must read.
And if anyone insists you do anything about kitchens, say that medically you're exempt.
I'm happy under this olive tree with Groot the Bull Terrier. Yeah. Oh, that was good fun, John. Cheers for that.
You have been listening to Spin Notes with Dr. Richard Miller and myself, John Gibbs, as we've discussed On the Nature of Things by Lucretius, a text from 2,000 years ago, which has been available in monastic libraries and all good bookshops currently. If you've enjoyed this episode, hopefully we'll be together as the Spinoza Triad again soon, where we'll discuss many topics. If you have any ideas or comments or suggestions, please leave them with us or email me, and share this podcast if you've enjoyed it. Thank you for listening. I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time the curtain edges will grow light. Till then I see what's really always there. Unresting death. A whole day nearer now. Making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I shall myself die. Arid interrogation. Yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify. The mind blanks at the glare. Not in remorse, the good not done, the love not given, time torn off unused, nor wretchedly because an only life can take so long to climb clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never. But at the total emptiness, forever, the sure extinction that we travel to, and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid. No trick dispels. Religion used to try, that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die. And specious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel. Not seeing that this is what we fear. No sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to think with, nothing to love with. The anaesthetic from which none come round. And so it stays, just on the edge of vision, a small unfocused blur, a standing chill that slows each impulse down to indecision. Most things may never happen, this one will. And realization of it rages out in furnace fear when we are caught without people or drink. Courage is no good. It means not scaring others. Being brave lets no one off the grave. Death is no different, whined at, than withstood. Slowly, light strengthens, and the room takes shape. It stands plain as a wardrobe. What we know, have always known, know we can't escape, yet can't accept. One side will have to go. Meanwhile, telephones crouch, getting ready to ring. In locked-up offices, all the uncaring, intricate, rented world begins to rouse. The sky is white as clay, with no sun. Work has to be done. Postmen, like doctors, go from house to house. Obeyed by Philip Larkin.